Thanks very much, Ron, and thank you once again to the Paul Woolley Centre for the opportunity to speak to you today. It is the third time I've spoken at this conference. 2 years ago, I discussed how to identify and communicate about risk. Last year, I talked about some policy approaches that might be used to respond to those risks. Today, I'd like to step back a little and reflect on society's tolerance for financial stability risks, what we might or might not give up to reduce the risks we face, and how some structural aspects of the financial sector might affect the risks it poses. Now, the global financial crisis spurred a huge international effort to reform financial regulation. That work is ongoing still, and it will be for some years. I don't think there's any doubt about why the crisis spurred such reforms. The events of the crisis showed that banks in many jurisdictions needed more capital, that governance and risk management needed to improve, and that risks in derivative markets and shadow banking needed closer scrutiny. But at a more fundamental level, the crisis showed that the prior settings of regulatory policy in some countries had not achieved the degree of financial stability that society actually wanted. You see, society only has so much appetite to impose risks on its members, and in particular, it only has so much appetite to impose risks on people who had little or nothing to do with the creation of those risks. We therefore have laws and regulations and other measures to reduce the chance that a bad event might happen. Think of pool fences, guardrails on the sides of roads, and special car seats for children. We also have insurance, welfare systems, and tort law to cushion the blow if a bad event does happen. How much of each of these measures we as a society choose depends on how much risk we are willing to bear or to impose on others, as well as on the price we are willing to pay to avoid or ameliorate those bad outcomes. And different countries make different choices about these issues. That is why the Australian authorities have consistently argued that international regulatory agreements need to be tailored to national circumstances. The global minimum standards, such as the Basel III framework, are just that, minimum standards. Countries are within their rights to choose to strengthen their local implementation of those minimum standards if need be. Sometimes some additional conservatism is needed because of particular features of each country's financial system. A good example of this is the long-standing, tighter setting of prudential capital rules on housing loans in Australia relative to what the Basel framework requires. Housing is a large part of the Australian banking system's asset base. It therefore makes sense to allow for that concentration. Even though housing loans are individually a lower risk than some of the other things banks could be doing with their balance sheets. In other cases, the authorities might choose to be a bit more conservative to reflect that society is a bit more risk-averse than in some other countries. Now, as a central banker, I am not in the business of claiming to have insights into the national psyche. Far from it. But it seems to me fair to say that Australia is not a society that tells people who have suffered misfortune that they are entirely on their own. Nor does our society apply the caveat investor principle to all financial dealings. We have consumer and investor protection rules to protect non-experts. We also have regulation to reduce various kinds of abuse. We're also very cognizant that actions that are rational for an individual can collectively result in a bad outcome. And that is where financial stability mandates become highly relevant. At the same time, it would not be ideal if people were completely insulated from the risks that they knowingly and willingly take on. A financial stability mandate does not mean that policymakers should try to ensure that nobody anywhere ever loses money. It does not mean that nobody anywhere should ever default on their loans. And it certainly does not mean that no individual financial institution anywhere should ever fail. What it does mean is that the harm done to the real economy, to the innocent bystanders, if you like, should be as small as can be reasonably managed. That implies that policies to promote financial stability should include a mix of preemptive measures to head off trouble and post-event responses to deal with trouble when it does occur. In other words, the authorities should both lean against risk and clean up the mess. So far, the global regulatory reform program has done a lot on the lean phase. Banks hold more capital, so they're less likely to fail. Supervision has been enhanced in the countries where this was needed, and compensation practices in financial firms have been overhauled and attract more scrutiny from regulators. Of course, there's still plenty of work that's been agreed internationally and is in the process of being implemented in each country. And much of this work being done at the moment relates to the clean phase. For example, a lot's being done to ensure that banks and other important parts of the financial system can be resolved effectively if they do fail. Now, as with any major regulatory reform, the reform program spurred by the crisis, and especially the higher capital requirements, has met with claims that it might harm growth. That is, some commentators argue that the reforms are trading off stability and efficiency. It's sometimes claimed that requiring banks to hold more capital will hold back credit growth and thus economic growth. In my view, there are a couple of problems with this argument. First, it assumes that credit growth causes economic growth. Now, there's some truth to this. If credit supply is constrained, for example, because the financial sector is weak, that can hold back growth. It would be a credit crunch of the kind described by Chairman Bernanke in his earlier academic work. There does seem to be some element of a credit crunch in places like the United Kingdom and the euro area at the moment. But slow credit growth can also be the result of weak demand for credit, not constrained supply. Causation doesn't flow all one way. Second, we should not assume that all financial activity needs encouragement. If a certain business line is only economic when too little capital is held to cover the risk it entails, it is not a business that should be pursued. For all the concerns about the financial system's ability to serve the real economy, it must be remembered that banks also have extensive connections with other parts of the financial system. That includes their activities in plain vanilla wealth management, but also some of the more rarefied segments like lending to hedge funds, structured investment vehicles, and other parts of the so-called shadow banking system. In the lead-up to the crisis, this part of the business became increasingly important for some banks, especially in a few major financial centres. Some of this was legitimate redistribution of risk to those best placed to bear it. But I question whether it all was. Lending to the real economy need not be the business line that is most affected by regulatory reform. Third, the recent crisis has shown how severe the costs of a crisis to the real economy can be. There's empirical evidence suggesting that recessions are deeper and longer if they're instigated by a banking crisis. A cost-benefit assessment suggests that society would be willing to pay some price to avoid those harms. The best available estimates of that trade-off, uncertain as they are, do imply that the regulatory reform program is a net benefit to society. A final point about this issue is that some regulation is essential to create stability. There is no trade-off. Society benefits greatly from the existence of a safe, liquid asset that people can rely on to make payments and which they can trust will not suddenly decline in nominal value. But we've learned over the centuries that the private sector cannot produce truly safe, truly liquid assets on its own. Without prudential supervision, central bank liquidity, and some form of depositor protection, the private sector cannot offer an asset that is both safe and liquid, even in bad times. The recent crisis was in part a story of people learning that assets they had previously been happy to treat as safe weren't completely safe. And they learned that lesson over and over in the crisis, with repo finance, asset-backed commercial paper, super senior collateralized debt obligation tranches, auction rate securities, money market funds, the list goes on. Now, another subtler critique of financial regulation argues that stability carries the seeds of its own destruction. The idea behind this line of argument is that imbalances always build up during the good times. So the longer you go without a small crisis, the larger the crisis you'll have eventually. Small, regular crises are therefore supposedly helpful and cleansing, and policymakers resist them at the economy's peril. Having gone for more than 20 years without a serious recession or major banking problem, Australia is going to be a good test of this particular hypothesis, though hopefully not any time soon. Underlying this argument must be some kind of model. And this is the moment where I pause and remind everybody that we write our speeches a couple of weeks in advance and we finalise the text a few days in advance. So I do feel like a little bit of a schmuck to use this particular model as metaphor at the moment, because often the model that is used is that of a forest fire. So I just want to say I really feel for the people who have lost their homes over the last 24, 36 hours in the in New South Wales. Please stay safe over the bushfire season. I do feel like this was particularly poor timing, and I apologise for my choice of metaphor, which it was too late to change. Because a forest fire is often used as a model, as metaphor, for thinking about this particular issue. Because in a forest, the argument goes, kindling builds up over time. And if it's not reduced through regular burnouts, expect a conflagration eventually. Now, it's useful to put these kinds of verbal arguments back in terms of the model implicitly underlying them. You can then find all the previously unstated assumptions and decide if they're appropriate to the question. In the case of the forest fire, I think the metaphor only goes so far, and so I'm not convinced of the argument. For a start, this model assumes that kindling always builds up at the same rate. Is the forest that suffers few fires building up more kindling? Or is it just that some kinds of trees are less prone to burn? And again, you know, the inappropriate metaphor. And in Australia, we're only too aware that eucalyptus trees are more flammable than many other species, and we're seeing that again in the recent days. So perhaps some kinds of banks are more prone to burst into flames, metaphorically, that is, than others. Now, when we talk about different species of banks and other financial institutions, we're really talking about business models. Within the banking industry globally, there are many different kinds of banks with different niches, risks, and balance sheet structures. You can classify them any number of ways, but one useful dimension to think about is a spectrum with investment banks at one end, commercial or retail banks at the other, and so-called universal banks in the middle. And so this graph shows that those labels correspond to different balance sheet structures. Investment banks like Morgan Stanley, as shown here, it's the left bar in each of the two panels, or Goldman Sachs or some of the other banks that you might know of, have a lot more trading assets than banks with different business models. Universal banks, or commercial banks like Wells Fargo, mainly have loans. And universal banks like JP Morgan, as shown here, or Citigroup, have a bit of both. You can see the same distinction on the liability side. Investment banks tend to have more wholesale and repo funding, commercial banks less so. Even starker are the differences in off-balance sheet business, which aren't shown here. Investment banks tend to have larger and more complex derivatives positions than commercial banks. And depending on a country's accounting rules, these positions are in some cases not on the balance sheet. The larger derivative positions of investment banks arise partly because of their own trading business and partly because they intermediate between other banks that wish to transfer risk or hedge particular exposures. This distinction between business models, different business models, is a strategic choice and not just an artefact of past restrictions built into the US regulatory structure, even though I'm showing US banks here. You can see it in banks around the world. So in Australia, for example, the big four banks are clearly at the commercial end of the spectrum. Much of their business involves servicing household and business customers in Australia and New Zealand. And as this graph shows, their trading books and other securities holdings are a relatively small part of their business. They're the little blue bars right down at the far right-hand side of the graph. They're among the least trading of the major, the 100 biggest banks in the world. So what does this mean for financial stability analysis and policy? Certainly, different business models lead to different balance sheet structures and therefore different risk exposures. Unlike the trees in the forest fire model, these differences come from conscious choices about their business models and strategy. Trees don't choose how flammable they are, but banks can choose their risk profiles. That said, tree species do evolve in response to the environments they face, just as individual banks and whole banking systems adjust to the incentives they face. Now, one of the most powerful sets of incentives for banks is, of course, the regulatory arrangements they're subject to. This brings me back to the International Program of Post-Crisis Regulatory Reform. In designing these reforms, it's been essential to consider how the regulated industries and their counterparties will respond. Those responses can change not just financial firms' behaviour, but sometimes their entire business models. Now, this isn't simply just a concern that the reforms will push business out of the supervised banking industry and into the shadow banking system, though that is part of the issue. It's also a concern to ensure that the different elements of the recent reforms are not in conflict with each other. There have, after all, been some elements that do seem rather at odds. For example, we want to make sure that financial institutions can absorb losses. Yet it would not make sense to demand that bail-inable wholesale debt should be so high that funding profiles became less stable. Likewise, we want derivative markets to be safer and more transparent. But we do not want to change the incentives so far away from uncleared over-the-counter markets that it weakens risk management in other ways. Some risks cannot be adequately hedged by a standardised clearable product. There will still be need to be bespoke but uncleared transactions that better match those risks. An uncleared trade might reduce risk by more than an imperfect hedge, or worse still, not hedging the risk at all. There needs to be balance. There is another issue in the International Regulatory Reform Program that we should also be mindful of. The reforms have gone a long way to promote international consistency in financial regulation. For example, for the first time, the Basel Committee is assessing how faithful each country's reforms have been to the agreed Basel III framework. And there will be further work on the consistency of risk weights across banks for the same exposure. This is important and helpful work. But in ensuring consistency, we do not want to create a monoculture with all of its members being vulnerable to the same risks because they face the same incentives. There is something to be said for allowing some diversity of business models so that the whole system doesn't collapse from a particular shock. That is one kind of diversity that I think needs more attention. It also needs to be allowed for when we design regulation. Another important dimension of diversity is that the financial system is made up of more than just banks. Insurance firms, pension funds, asset managers, and financial infrastructure providers are all part of the landscape. They each have different capacities and face diverse risks. They too need to be regulated in ways that are adapted to that diversity. Now, so far, I've been talking about risk, regulation, and different business models. None of that is a typical concern of macroeconomics and monetary policy, which are the usual fare at central banks. Macroeconomics doesn't have a monopoly on wisdom when it comes to financial stability issues. Banking and finance are important sources of insight. So are disciplines like accounting, actuarial science, complex systems, and industrial organisation. And we should never forget the lessons of economic and financial history. Over the past few years at the Reserve Bank, we've found ourselves delving into areas as diverse as the mathematics of networks and the intricacies of tax law. None of that is taught in a conventional macroeconomics major. The things a financial stability policymaker typically needs to know don't look much like conventional macro. In financial stability departments, being able to read a balance sheet is at least as useful as being able to solve for the rational expectations equilibrium of some macroeconomic model. Now, I don't think there needs to be a special financial stability degree the way they are degrees in economics or finance or actuarial studies. Speaking as someone who did major in macroeconomics, I have found that you can learn a lot of what you need on the job over the years. Clearly, though, the building blocks of financial stability education are already there. There's a lot the world already knows about financial analysis, about credit risk, about banking crises. There's also a lot already known about financial history, organisational behaviour, and complex systems. And although it's fair to say that we know rather less about asset pricing dynamics and how some of these micro-level behaviours build up to macro-level instability, I do believe that academics and practitioners can work together to expand the frontier of knowledge here too. Central banks need to harness those diverse sources of expertise in their financial stability function. That means that the monetary policy function, which naturally has an intellectual culture based on macroeconomics, mustn't unduly overshadow contributions from other perspectives. Economics as a discipline has a bit of a reputation for colonising other domains, but central banks need to give space and respect to a range of disciplines, a diverse range of disciplines. Now, I can see two ways to avoid problems around this issue, and I'm glad to say that both of those are definitely practiced here in Australia. One is to ensure that we recruit from a broader stream, including macroeconomics, but not limited to it. The fact that the Reserve Bank also has a long-standing policy mandate for payment system stability and efficiency helps here. That area needs microeconomists and lawyers, as well as macrofinance skills. Another way is to ensure that financial stability policy is a collective endeavour. The dominant economics culture of a central bank finds a counterpoint in the accounting, finance and actuarial cultures of prudential supervision and in the more legal-oriented cultures of securities regulators. We can learn a lot from each other and gain a lot from working together. Our mandates differ somewhat, but they are consistent. That is, some diversity with overall consistency. That sounds like something that would make a financial system and the regulation that shapes it strong enough to achieve stability. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks very much. So the question was, well, what are the risks of financial stability at the moment? And in particular, what do I want to expand on what we said about housing and self-managed super funds? Well, taking the second bit of that first, we explicitly said in the financial stability review that self-managed super funds are not a near-term risk to financial stability. I think what I would emphasise here is, in some ways, if you want two rules of thumb to know what to do about financial stability analysis, one is take a closer look at things that are growing quickly, and the second one is follow the spruikers. And the fact that self-managed super funds have certainly been a market for a lot of advertising at the moment, promoting what is essentially a very concentrated and leveraged asset in their super funds, so you could end up with quite a deal of asset concentration. That's certainly a sort of investor protection issue, and I've certainly learned over the years that investor protection issues are often a signal of a potential but not definite financial stability risk further down the track. Our observation, and we did a lot of work on this. In fact, there's a number of my colleagues in the room, and I'm studiously not going to look over at the table to identify the analyst who actually did most of the work who's in the room. But we found that actually most of the property that's in self-managed super is actually in commercial real estate. There's a number of tax reasons for that. The residential side is growing quickly, but from a very low base. So what we said in the financial stability review is this is a new source of demand that wasn't previously there. Until, 2010, self-managed super funds or super funds generally could not borrow. So this was a sector that really didn't have scope to to contribute to demand for property, to residential property. So it's an additional source of demand dynamic that we're just going to have to keep a good eye on in the future. So the self-managed piece, you know, that's what's going on. In terms of housing more generally, my boss, Malcolm Eadie, was asked that question a few weeks ago, and nothing has changed since he gave his answer. The important point is, yes, you know, housing prices are picking up, but the important point is over a longer run, they've been cycling around a sort of roughly income growth. I would endorse the phrase he used, which I think was unrealistic alarmism. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who want to sort of, you know, the minute house prices start to pick up, they say, oh my goodness, you know, we'll all be ruined. You know, it's the housing Hanrahans, a kind of, you know, want to see the minute housing prices start to pick up, they imagine it's a bubble. Well, you know, we know perfectly, this is not an institution that is in denial about the possibility of bubbles. It's not an institution that's in denial about the possibility of bubbles in the housing market. There was definitely one in the US. We came very close to having one in 02, 03. I think you can debate whether you want to put the label on it for 02 and 03. But if a dispassionate comparison of the data between 02, 03 and now, there's no comparison. I mean, that was an era where credit growth was growing quickly, housing prices were growing quickly, rental yields were low and falling, the household saving ratio was negative, there were lots of new products, easing lending standards in the credit markets, investor interest in housing was really, really strong. The real economy was also kind of, you know, experiencing spillovers from all of that. You compare that with now, well, yes, you know, housing prices have been growing, but they were falling until recently. I do feel a lot like it's not that dissimilar to 2010. Look, interest rates are lower than average, and that is, you know, part of the transmission mechanism of monetary policy is that you will see some effect in asset markets and in credit markets. But the important point here is, you know, we're not seeing a credit-fueled speculative boom. It's not credit-fueled. What's going on at the moment is not credit-fueled. There's actually a paragraph in a speech I gave to the AFR conference in 2010 where I said, you know, currently the data do not suggest that we have a credit-fueled speculative boom on our hands. And it feels a little bit like Groundhog Day to me because I could say the exact same thing about today.
Would you agree that there is a trade-off between competition and stability, and that Australia has benefited from having only four large profitable banks during the past difficult period?
Well, we had a number of profitable banks during that period. This was a banking system where sort of sustained losses were not recorded, even in the smaller banks. I think it's true to say that there's been a typical pattern in Australia and a number of other countries. You know, most countries have, you know, a big three, four, five or six. The US and Germany are kind of exceptions to this. But most countries, a concentrating banking system is quite normal. And, you know, we only have 2.5 supermarkets as well. So, you know, concentrated markets are not that, you know, not specific to Australia or specific to banking. Competition is not part of the Reserve Bank remit, so I don't really want to go too far. I think it's an interesting topic that's worth exploring, but we also have to remember that what tends to happen is in the bad times, you know, a middle-sized bank that's in trouble, you know, we think back to the state banks in Australia in the 1990s. Well, they all got bought by the big banks. That increased the market share of the big banks. But then what happened over the next 15 or 20 years? Other people came in, the securitisation came in, and the banks lost market share again. And so there's this sort of cycle that, you know, bad times do seem to be easier for stronger banks, and particularly larger, stronger banks, but, you know, it's all part of a cycle, and, you know, new competition does come in. So I think an important point is not necessarily the point in time degree of competition, but also how contestable a market is. And I think banking is pretty contestable. Yeah, I mean, the lean clean is just sort of a more general, you know, way of describing these things. So the question for the benefit of the tape was that in terms of leaning versus cleaning, is it better to do it with macroprudential policy rather than monetary policy? And so I guess I should start my answer with the question, were you here last year? Okay, I gave a speech on macroprudential policy last year and I haven't changed my mind in the last 12 months. I think Australia has a what is macroprudential policy anyway? I think we would think that the prudential regulator has a financial stability mandate in Australia, and I think the design of your prudential framework can have an eye to macroprudence. One thing I'm not necessarily convinced of is the idea that you've got this lever, monetary policy at one end, and then you've got this other lever or button called macroprudential policy on the other. And I mean, it's not always clear to me that the macroprudential policies that are suggested are in fact appropriately targeted. And I think one example I could give is, supposing you have very low interest rates, a genuinely booming housing market, but a high exchange rate and the rest of the economy is struggling. Would you choose a countercyclical capital buffer to lean against that? Well, I would argue that you would not, because housing lending is not that capital intensive, but it's very interest sensitive. Whereas the sectors that are exchange rate sensitive are usually less interest sensitive than housing, but are more capital intensive. Think of small business finance, small exporters. So a countercyclical capital buffer across the whole of the bank balance sheet in those circumstances would be completely misdirected if that was your problem. If your problem is that you don't have full control over your own monetary policy because of your exchange rate regime, well then you do have to try and find a substitute for monetary policy. But if the problem is loose monetary policy, well then the answer is not loose monetary policy. Okay, so that was a long question, and for the benefit of the tape, I'm going to try and summarise it. And it was essentially the point that superannuation assets are roughly the same magnitude as the stock market, and so and as GDP. And so what are the implications of that in future, given that superannuation assets are likely to grow quickly, and could that potentially bid up assets? What implications does that have for financial stability and the development of the financial system? I think that's a really interesting question, and if you look at the financial stability review that we put out last month, you'll notice that actually we beefed up our superannuation sector, not just about self-managed, but about funds management more generally. I mean, the growth of superannuation in Australia is a development that we did not fail to notice, and consequently, we're very alert to what that might mean for, different responses of asset dynamics and what that might mean for credit growth and so forth. I'm not sure I buy that the fact that there's only so much ASX will mean that somehow everyone's constrained, because other things will adjust. Firstly, there isn't actually an investment mandate to superannuation funds that they must only invest in the ASX rather than equity in other countries. And we're a small part of the world. So I think the important issue there is the capacity of superannuation funds to manage FX risk. And so you need a deep and liquid hedging market to make that happen. You need an FX swap to make that happen. Now, the good news is Australia has a very deep and liquid two-sided FX swap market, because you've got banks borrowing offshore in foreign currency. They don't want foreign currency. They want Aussie dollars. So they want to swap one way. And you've got a combination of kangaroo bond issuers and Australian funds managers investing offshore, who've got, so the funds managers have got foreign currency and they, a foreign currency asset, and they want an Australian dollar asset. And so there's a natural two-sided market for these swaps. And I mean, this is actually one of the things that the global investment banks are involved in. They're sort of sitting in the middle, intermediating this risk transfer. And, it's a very stabilising system to be able to do this. A lot of countries do not have the privilege of being able to access global capital markets without it blowing up in their face from FX risk. Which is what we saw in the Asian crisis. So I guess my answer will be other things will adjust, and part of that will be the investment mandate of super funds will just be more diverse. That's probably a good thing. There will still need to be deep and liquid FX swap markets. There'll need to be good risk management in super funds. And I guess actually one of the interesting points is actually, and this comes down to the box we wrote on super fund, self-managed super, in the financial stability review, where we noted that self-managed super had about the same allocation to domestic equities as other kinds of super funds, but they've got almost no allocation to foreign equities. And so in some sense, maybe one of the issues is that there's going to be a trade-off between becoming, managing your own, becoming more self-managed, having more control, and actually having that diversity of allocation. But, you know, that's kind of in the realm of speculation. I think that the answer to your question is other things will adjust. Well, Richard just pointed out that there's a very large amount of regulation still coming down the pike and needing to be implemented, and some of the people who've been busy working on that are sitting quite near you and remarkably not looking very tired. And, you know, I'm sure you're feeling it on the other side. You know, there has been a lot of implementation work. You know, the regulators are well aware of that and the implementation risks. I think one thing I would point out is liquidity regulation isn't exactly a new phenomenon. Prudential supervisors have been supervising liquidity and putting rules on liquidity for years. This is just the first time they've been able to agree across countries about having a standard. And I think that's, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, prudential supervision wasn't invented by the Basel Committee. It was about supervisors trying to come together to create a level playing field that wasn't a lowest common denominator. And when sort of Basel I and Basel II were first agreed, they could agree on capital, but liquidity was just not able to be agreed at that time. Whereas now, you know, that has now been agreed. And I mean, it's interesting. It's the same thing has also happened in insurance. Until now, there hasn't been a global capital standard for insurance companies, and the International Association of Insurance Supervisors has now announced that they will develop one. So, you know, that's an incredibly positive development. So, you know, I think all of the, you know, all of the regulators are very conscious that there are big implementation burdens that have to be managed both by the regulators themselves and by the institutions that are regulated. I think we're very conscious of that, and there is a lot of thought into, you know, this is why there are these, you know, drawn out schedules. This is why, you know, things didn't all come in at once. This is why, you know, you have, you know, monitoring periods, and then, you know, things like the leverage ratio they're going to monitor and then refine if needs be. I mean, I think people are very conscious of that.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks. Thank you very much.